Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I love being in, I live in LA now, so I love being in Denver. It's great. I love it because of the, you know, obviously the weather. And then on the way here, we were on the highway and it was weird because the cars were moving, which they don't do in LA. But also because I lived in Evergreen for about 15 years, I guess, and I love Colorado. I'm trying to move back to Colorado. I'm negotiating a place in Frisco as we speak, and it's not going that great, but I'm hoping to close on that deal and get that place and get back here to the mountains because I just love this area. And so thank you for coming out. That's wonderful. It's wonderful to see everybody here. You know, I used to do this all the time. I used to stand up and talk at people, and that was because I had this whole thing going where I was writing these humor books. I wrote this one book called 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter. Rule number one, if you pull in my driveway and honk, you better be delivering a package because you sure as heck are not picking anything up. And of course, my favorite rule was rule number four, which was, you may have heard that in today's world, sex without a barrier method of some kind can kill you. Well, let me elaborate on that. When it comes to sex, I am the barrier, and I will kill you. And then I moved on. I wrote a book called How to Remodel a Man, because while I was out there on the stump, I was out there talking to people, I sort of determined that there was a whole group of people who would like to change men, and for want of a better term, I call these people women. So I decided to write a book about something impossible, which is a how to change a man, because it's because women don't understand men. A man is like a you know what it's like? A man is like a brontosaurus. You remember the brontosaurus was this enormous creature, so big that he had a big brain in his head, of course, but then he had another little brain all the way in the tail, just for his tail. Well, a man is like that, only without the big brain. In fact, there's a survey I love because it shows that 75% of the time, men are thinking of one of three things. Sports, sex, or nothing at all. So anyway, I always thought that if you did like one of those mind maps of men, it would look like Wyoming at night. You know, there'd just be darkness and a little light here, a little light there. Then I wrote a book called 8 Simple Rules for Marrying My Daughter. And then I got into writing books that have a dog on the cover. And that changed things because I can't stand up and do 45 minutes of dog jokes. I don't know. I mean, I have one dog joke. So here it comes. So there's these two brothers, Nathan and Charlie, and Nathan is the go-getter, and Nathan has a good job, and Nathan supports his brother and his mother. They all live together because Charlie's one of those guys that can't seem to get off the couch. You know, he just can't seem to get going. And Nathan puts up with this for a little while and finally says to Charlie, you know, it's been years since I've had a break. I'm going to take one of those vacations that you see where you can't reach me. I'm going to be on a boat. My cell phone won't work. You won't be able to talk to me. Charlie, can you handle my dog and mom for a week? Can you do that? And Charlie says, yeah, I can do that. Are you sure? Yeah, dude, go on the boat. So Nathan goes on the boat. It lasts about 3 days and he can't take it. He's anxious. So he goes up to the thing, you know, and gets the ship to shore. And he calls home and he says, Charlie, I know I said I wouldn't call, but I just want to check in. How's it going? And Charlie says, oh, it's going okay. And Nathan says, well, how's my dog? And Charlie says, oh, your dog's dead. And Nathan says, Charlie, you don't, you I'm on vacation. You don't just dump that on me like that. You let me work up to it. You say, the dog jumped the fence this morning. So then I'm starting to think, oh no, and then when I call, you say, no, we can't find your dog. And I'm worried, but I'm preparing myself for the bad news. And so finally, when you say, we found your dog and your dog's dead, then, you know, I kind of saw it coming. And Charlie says, dude, you're right. I'm so sorry. Nathan says, no, it's okay, Charlie. How's mom? And he says, well, mom jumped the fence this morning. That's it for the dog jokes. I don't have any more. And also, what I'd like to do actually is talk more about what you came here to hear. I think that there's a way now where the interactivity of everything has really changed the way people expect to interact with person. I just keep using the word over again, interact, the way we interact. But if you have questions, we're just going to do that right from the top. Like if you came here with a specific thing you want to talk about, a lot of people are very curious why I wrote a book called 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter, which became a TV show with John Ritter. John Ritter was playing me. Why did I do that? And I said, well, I felt like I was living in a zombie movie, because you know you'd open the door and there'd be this guy, you know, standing on your step, and you know, is Lee home? No, you know, slow. But you'd send them away, but there were more coming down the driveway, and they looked like zombies and they smelled like zombies. So, and you know, here's what happened. It was the guys that would slouch and mumble and evade my eyes. These guys made me very suspicious. I knew they were up to something. However, if a young man came in, looked me in the eye, shook my hand, called me sir, these guys made me very suspicious. I knew they were up to something. So I was just being a father when I wrote 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter. The reason there were 8 rules is it was a column for the Rocky Mountain News and I had 700 words. Believe me, I could have added more. So if you have questions, like that's an example of a good question. If you have a question and you want to raise your hand, I'd be happy to answer them. And I'm also going to do a little housekeeping and tell you about some other neat stuff. We're going to give away some ornaments and some hard copies of The Midnight Dog of the Repo Man. This tells the story of how Ruddy McCann met his dog, Jake. Ruddy McCann I wanted to call him the hero of the book Midnight Plan of the Repo Man, but Ruddy's not really a hero. He was the town hero because he was the like this football savant. This guy could play football, and everybody knew that an NFL career was ahead of him. He was living in Kalkaska, Michigan, a very cold place. You know, during the winter, it's very cold. And then during the 2 weeks of summer, it's kind of nice. They have a population of 2,000 people. So Ruddy was the hero. And then Ruddy made a mistake that got him sent to prison. And when he got out of prison, he was nobody. And he got a job as a repo man. And then in order to meet glamorous people, he got a job as a bouncer in a bar. And that was basically Ruddy's life. And then it got worse. Because Ruddy started to hear a voice in his head, which, as we all know, is a bad sign, right? And so it's driving him a little crazy. So he wants his voice to shut up, but the voice won't shut up. And the voice says, I'm not just a voice. I'm a person. I'm a man. I'm a real man. I'm a real dead man. I'm a man who was murdered. And Ruddy, I need you to find the people who did this to me and bring them to justice. And that is the underlying premise of The Midnight Plan of the Repo Man. Along the way, we get to meet Jake, who is Ruddy's dog. Jake does not want to go for a walk. Jake is based on my dog, Tucker, because I'll be like, Tucker, let's go for a walk. And Tucker's like, I'm good. You go. I'm good. And Tucker was bred from a long line. The only thing I could determine, we don't know is what his breed is exactly, but as far as I can determine, he comes from a long line of dogs that were trained to dig stereo cables out from underneath the living room carpet. He'll let it go for a while, and then I'll hear him, and I'll hear that, and I'll be like, Tucker, cut it out. And because we live in the city, it's my job to follow him around with a bag and pick up after him. Which and sometimes I'm finding carpet fibers there, which means he's eating the evidence. Anyway, that's my dog Tucker, and so his personality really informs this lazy dog Jake. Because you guys know I like dogs, right? I mean, I write these dog books. Anybody here read A Dog's Purpose? Okay, thank you. And then there's a couple. There was somebody we were talking about the fact that you're afraid to read it because they're afraid it's going to be sad. But there are people shaking their head. They're saying, "No, you got to read it." So. But in her defense, she read A Dog's Journey and found it to be sad. Anybody read A Dog's Journey, the sequel to A Dog's Purpose? Okay. I mean, if you liked A Dog's Purpose, A Dog's Journey continues the story of the dog and a dog's purpose. So A Dog's Journey, highly recommended by the author himself. Every book that we sell tonight, regardless of whether it's The Midnight Plan of the Repo Man or A Dog's Purpose, A Dog's Journey, will result in a contribution of $2 from me to the wonderful rescue, Life is Better Rescue. Operates here locally in Denver, specializes in saving death row animals, going into situations where there is an animal that is slated to be put down and rehabilitating that animal. Sometimes it's because the animal needs medical attention. Sometimes it's been abused and it is the opinion of the shelter that it is irredeemably challenged and changed. And that is another situation that Life is Better addresses. And it's not just dogs, it's cats, horses, couple times a chicken, which I don't know how that one turned out. I don't know if they adopt them out in a bucket. I'm not sure how that works. But that's – they released the pheasant. Yeah, the pheasant was really happy to go back to being prey. So there's that. Life is Better Rescue. I really support it. My daughter, Georgia Lee, sitting back in the back, is the president of Life is Better Rescue. And I'm very proud of that. So while I've been blathering away, has anybody thought of a question? Yes, you. Yes. Wow. Would you like me to give you a list? Because I can think of one right off the top of my head.
No, what I want to know is, this is a mystery.
Yes. Yes. It is not a traditional mystery because we get to hear from the murder victim, or at least we hear from something that claims to be the murder victim. I mean, if you have a voice in your head, you know, I mean, Son of Sam had a voice in his head and it turned out to be the neighbor's beagle. I mean, that's a true story. So, you know, this is not like that exactly because the guy is a realtor, not a beagle. Well, yeah. Yeah. I would not classify. I resist the paranormal classification. Paranormal, I mean, any classification is basically there for marketing. People love paranormal mysteries right now. So that's the marketing label on it. I resisted a little bit because to me it's just a straightforward mystery because if I had a voice in my head that claimed to be dead and I started checking into the story and it didn't seem to be checking out but then some things did seem to be checking out, I'd be concluding that maybe I had picked up in some details and forgotten them and now they're coming together in a murder mystery that I'm solving and that's how my life is going. That's how I would feel. And this has never happened to me, but I was a repo man in northern Michigan. Kalkaska was part of my territory. So I had what I consider to be nerves of stupidity because I would risk my life to steal a Chevy Chevette worth $500. And I look back, I just do not understand what I could have been thinking. And some of the stuff that happens in The Midnight Plan of the Repo Man is based on some of the stuff that happened to me when I was a repo man. I was never a bouncer in a bar. I don't think I could be a bouncer maybe in like in a candy store, but not a – I'd be like, hey, cut that out. And they'd be like, yeah, I'm going to call my mom. That would be funny if my mom were here, because my mom is like this tall right now. But I'm also – I am here to celebrate the release of this book, and also because I've got a movie out. I co-wrote with this marvelous screenwriter, Catherine Michon. I co-wrote a book called Muffin Top, A Love Story. And it's a – did I say book? It's a movie – not a book. It's a movie that will be playing tomorrow in Boulder one night only, because we're doing a red carpet premiere tour. And the director is Catherine Michon, and she happens to be here in the audience. Wave, Catherine. And so Catherine Catherine wrote a book called The Girl Genius Guide to Sex with Other People. And it's a pretty hilarious book, as you might guess from the title. Pretty wacky. And then she just wanted to make a movie out of it, and so she did. I mean, that's kind of the best way to describe it, is that she was unstoppable. We had a year's worth of technical difficulties, and there were so many times when it would have been easy just to say, you know what, let's get in the lifeboat and row away from this thing. And she just never let up. And now the movie's out and it's absolutely hilarious. You probably won't be able to see it because we've sold out, but you could get it on video on demand. It's on AT&T and Comcast and Charter and iTunes and every place you can. I'm sorry, DirecTV. We have a very informed person in the audience. Any place really you can stream a movie except Netflix, and for some reason Time Warner hasn't carried it yet, but I'm sure they will. So, Muffin Top, A Love Story, I will be giving you a postcard which tells you all you need to know about this fabulous movie. It's a lot of fun to write a movie and have it come out. I have written the screenplay for A Dog's Purpose. I've written the screenplay for The Dogs of Christmas. Has anybody read the Dogs of Christmas? Thank you. Thank you. So I've written the screenplay for that with Catherine. She's my writing partner. I've basically sold into development everything I've written, and none of it has ever gotten made with the exception of 8 Simple Rules. That's how that works out there. So it's just a blast to have a movie actually made. I can't tell you, as a writer, when I talk to people, screenwriters, they're like, and you got a movie made? That's fantastic, because that just never happens. Was anybody else have a question while we're sitting here? Because I want to tell you a little bit about The Dogs of Christmas. Here's what happened. There's so much bad going on in the world that, I mean, you could just literally, if you want to read the newspaper, if you want to dwell on it, you can find something really horrible to think about every single day. And I decided I wanted to write a book that was uplifting and fun and cheerful. So it's about puppies at Christmas. If that doesn't cheer you up, I can't help you. It is a book that I wrote so that you could give it to your grandmother or your grandson. It is the story of a man who lives in Evergreen, Colorado, and he has the life that a lot of young people are getting to, where he's looking at his screens all the time. He's kind of disconnected from people. His girlfriend has dumped him. He's never had a dog. He's alone in this cabin that he inherited from his parents, and he's way up in the woods in the mountains, and he's just kind of becoming a hermit, a modern-day hermit who feels like he's connected because he's writing emails, you know? And all of a sudden, he winds up with not only a dog, but a bunch of puppies. And this changes his life in many ways, for the good mostly, but in many ways. My dog, Tucker, came to me. And this is how I tell the story, by the way, so don't start correcting me back there, because she was – Georgia was involved in it. But my dog Tucker came to me because some person completely stripped of humanity took newborn puppies still slick with birth, stuffed them in a box, and took them to the shelter. And, you know, the thing about rescue that a lot of people don't understand is it's like a river. It has to keep flowing. The shelters that are kill shelters, as gut-wrenching it is to suppose that animals are being put down, what you have to understand is that we need that spot for other dogs that are constantly being abandoned or lost, and they need a home. Otherwise, they just stay on the streets. And so this was a shelter that was a kill shelter. And when they opened the box in the morning, these puppies had somehow survived the night. And so they didn't have the resources to take care of these newborns, because to sit and bottle feed, you know, every hour a bunch of puppies, that's just too much manpower. And that's something they don't have. So I got distracted by the screaming. I don't know what's going on. So they called Georgia at Life is Better, and they said, you know, we've got these puppies that we're going to have to put down. Can you take care of them? And her answer is kind of the same. I mean, she doesn't have the staff to devote a person to taking care of puppies. And she said, I do have a German Shepherd who just weaned her pups like yesterday. So let's give it a shot. So they brought the box of puppies into this German Shepherd who was, you know, so relieved to have gotten rid of her, you know, her brood. And I don't know what to say. They probably said, hey, remember that wild weekend at the Sigma Chi house? Here you go. And they handed the puppies over to the dog, and with a sigh, she lay back down, and that's how Tucker survived what would have been a death event in this you know, hours old puppy's life. Georgia called me. I live in LA. I live in a high rise. And she said, I've got this dog for you. It's going to be perfect for you. And I said, I'm not ready. I'm too busy. I'll adopt locally when I get around to it. She said, I'll be there Wednesday, because that's how she rolls. So she brought Tucker, and the minute we saw Tucker, he just bounded into our hearts, and he has been he's been in charge of the stereo cables ever since. So the Dogs of Christmas kind of extracted that story, and that makes up a lot of what's going on that winds up with all these puppies that we have to adopt out, and the young man whose life changes forever. So there's that one. I would like to briefly mention one more book, which is it's coming. It's a book that I've got coming out in August, so I want you all to be thinking about August. Here's this book from Bruce Cameron, because it is the story of the very first dog. Because I have always heard that it'll go something like this. When the first wolf came over and sat next to us at the campfire and joined us as our companion, ... And I'm thinking, how would that ever happen? Wolves were, like everybody, starving. They saw us as prey or competitors for their food supply. Why would they come sit next to us? They're not going to come sit next to us. And certainly we're not going to start feeding wolves. We don't have any food ourselves. So I started pondering, how could this happen? What's really interesting about when it happened, it was the last glaciation. Ice was storming out of the north. It was plowing over trees. It was forcing us out of the trees where we had lived, basically like our ape ancestors, out under the steppes, where now we can be seen by these enormous monsters. I mean, the bears. There's a skeleton of a guy standing next to a skeleton of one of these extinct bears. And the shoulder is like this high. This is like a 6 foot tall guy. This would have been, it could run 45 miles an hour. You'd see this thing coming, and you're coming at you. What are you thinking? You're thinking, I don't know. You're thinking, I wish I had a pack of wolves to defend me, I guess. So, and at the same time, there was another humanoid. There were the Neanderthals. And the Neanderthals were smarter than we were. They had bigger brains. They may not have been smarter, but we think they probably were. They were certainly tougher. They had much bigger bones, much bigger muscles. They were clearly faster. So you've got basically, you know, these John Elways running around. How in the world did we survive? And the Dog Master is the name of that book, and it's coming out in August, and it tells the reason why we're here, and I'm not speaking to a room full of Neanderthals. No insult implied at all. Does anybody else have anything you want me to talk about while I'm here? Came all this way to chat with you. If you have something you want me to discuss, we should do it. We have a couple more minutes. Yes. Yeah. Picture a man in a flat out panic. No, actually I have a wonderful process, because I should tell you that my writing process started long, long ago because I have never been able to pay attention. Because the second a teacher would stand up and say, today we're going to talk about the triangle, you know, my mind would be off and running. And I would picture what would happen if all of a sudden a flood came and the door banged open and the water comes in and I swim over and I would save Nancy Bootman and then she would be in love with me. A lot of my fantasies had Nancy Bootman in the center of them. But that was my problem, is I would always have these stories. And the older I got and the more sophisticated they became. And to discover that I could actually write these things down and get them out of my head was almost a relief. So for me, the process of writing is first off to get the story figured out. What happens? I kind of do it backwards. Most people I know, they start with these characters and it's really interesting. For me, it's what happened. And then I figure out who it happened to. I figure out how people would react to it, and then I tweak their personality to give them a different reaction. When I'm ready, I go – the next stage is to go to drawing pictures. I draw – not art, but like bubbles, like question marks and arrows and things like that, and that gets translated. So then that's this mess, and then I put it in a database because I was a database programmer. So then now it's in a database, a completely different format, very regimented, and that's how I outline the thing. And then I have an outline, because when I was hired to write a screenplay, my first screenplay was 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter. They had a concept. They said, what if we made a movie while the TV show is still on the air? Wouldn't that be kind of cool? You know, same stars, put out the movie, right? And so they hired me to write the screenplay. And it really would have maybe gotten made if John Ritter hadn't passed away. So I had never written a screenplay before. And so I knew – I had met this woman. Her name was Catherine Michon, and she was an experienced screenwriter. She had written for TV for several years, and she just knew all about that. And I said, well, what do I do? And one of the first things she had me do was read this book called Screenplay by Sid Field. And even though he was talking about screenplays, I realized that his absolutely disciplined, relentless organization and outlining was something that I lacked in my own art. That in novel writing, I had always sort of taken the approach of just – well, I can kind of see where this is going, you know, and I would start off to the races. A lot of my books made no sense. And I was trying to chase the market. Like, the market was trying to – like, the market wanted international thrillers at one point. So even though – so I decided I'm going to write about international stuff, you know. I can do that, even though I'd only been to Canada. So I wrote a book about somebody who was in, like, Latin America, which, as I described it, looked a lot like Canada. And it was probably a terrible book, and I wrote actually 9 unpublished novels before I sold my first one, which was 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter. Spent most of my life as an unsuccessful novelist, but I couldn't stop. I had to get these stories out of my head so I could make room for the next one, sort of like Animal Rescue. Anyway, does that answer the question? Kind of. It's all about organization. Yes, sir. Yes, sir?
I'm going to try to talk for him. It's my husband.
Okay. My wife does the same thing for me, so.
And sometimes his speech is, you know, in and out. Yeah. Now he could be verbose for right now.
Okay.
But he's
going to
see you in living color.
This is me.
Because my husband is a great, prolific reader, loves mystery and suspense, detective novels. It is not my genre at all. However, he read your repo book.
Oh, you read that?
He was a repo man.
And all right.
In Venice. And,
oh, my.
You know, with Bank of America and those places and Bounty Hunter and all that. He would quote to me every other page. You've got to hear this. This guy is so right on. You know, he just loved that book.
Yeah. You and I are brothers in arms on this repo stuff. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
He said, this guy is so right, because everything he was, he could see himself in. So
thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Just imagine this stuff. You kind of walk.
You are welcome. Thank you. And I live in Marina Del Rey, which is right – I actually live a block from Venice. So I know that – I know your old stomping grounds. I probably have met a lot of your old customers. I'll tell them you said hi. Yes, sir.
You miss doing columns?
I loved doing a columns. I was, and then something really fun happened to me. I was the newspaper columnist of the year in 2011, and I realized that that's probably the top award I was ever going to get, and it felt good to quit when I was on top. What I do miss the column. It actually disciplined me. It made me, you know, I had to be very focused on making sure that I wrote every single week because I had a column every single week. But interesting stuff just doesn't happen to me that much anymore, you know? And I just ran out of stuff to write about. I mean, how many times can you take kayak lessons and, you know, fall off the skis and go snowboarding? I mean, I did that, you know? So I just ran out of – I just became less and less interesting to myself. And finally just gave it up. It was a perfect time to resign. My column still runs all over the world. It's still syndicated, and they just keep recycling it, you know. And I'm sure there's stuff in there about, you know, President Carter or something like that, and they just keep running it again and again, you know. I don't know. But thank you for that. Do you miss my column? Thank you. I appreciate that, yeah. And the subject of many of my columns is sitting in the back row. I wanted to tell you one last story because when I was on my How to Remodel a Man tour, I started talking about how men are tool-using animals. And women, because women would say to me, how many tools does my husband need? And I'd say, all of them. You know, we would get these. You get these catalogs, the tool catalog. It's like a Christmas catalog for a kid. A man's going through. Oh yeah, I need that. I need that. I bought a plumb bob once. I don't know what it is. It's just got a cool name. It's a plumb bob. It wasn't that expensive. It looks like this. I don't know. It looks like a top, but it doesn't spin very well. So, man also is a tool making animal. One time I was on a junket because I worked for this small family owned company called General Motors, and they had sent us on. A sales junket, which is where a bunch of people get together and go to the bar. I don't know what else you're supposed to do on these things, but that's what we did. So after spending some time in the bar, this guy, Ted, and I went back to this condo where we were staying with two other guys. And I went to bed. I got up a little while later and saw that the light was on underneath the door. And I opened up the door, and there's this guy, Ted, and he's standing in the living room like a soldier. I said, Ted, what are you doing? He said, well, here's what he said. This was back when contact lenses were hard, and he couldn't get one of them off his eye. And he knew that if he fell asleep with this on his eye, that that would be bad. So he decided to stand all night in the living room because then he wouldn't fall asleep. Ted was, I'm sure he went on to become president of General Motors. So, I realized that in this condo that we shared with two other guys, there was a full kitchen, and the full kitchen had a refrigerator freezer, and in the freezer there was an ice maker, and the ice maker had a metal arm that would rise up and down with the level of ice. It would rise to a certain level, and it would turn off the ice machine. To keep that metal arm from adhering to the ice, it was covered in a rubber sleeve that I realized I could remove and use as a thin, flexible straw to suck the contact lens off Ted's eye. Because man is a tool-making animal. So I had Ted lie on the couch, and I took that straw, and I put it in my mouth, and I straddled him, and I leaned over, and I touched that to his eye, and just then the other two guys walked in. I said, yes, gentlemen, this is exactly what it looks like. So I'm going to be here to sign books. I'm going to just sit right here and sign your books if you want. If you want to come up and talk to me personally, I would love to do that. Thank you so much for coming tonight. I really appreciate it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodin. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.